This is KOOP HD1 HD3 Hornsby. Welcome to Civil Rights and Wrongs, the state of your civil liberties in the Lone Star State. The views expressed here are not necessarily those of the co-op board of directors, staff, volunteers, or underwriters. The following program is homecrafted and was recorded on August 5th. On June 19th, Newsweek reported that the U.S. Supreme Court had rejected the Trump administration's efforts to terminate the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals Program, or DACA. This program has protected as many as 800,000 Dreamers, that is, recipients of DACA protection, from deportation. The court ruling was essentially based on procedural considerations, claiming that the Trump administration had acted arbitrarily and capriciously. The authors of the Newsweek article point out that federal legislation is needed to guarantee the security of Dreamers. According to a Pew Research poll, 74% of Americans are in favor of legal protections, and support is bipartisan. On the other hand, without legislation that grants permanent status, Dreamers will continue to live in the margins, at best renewing their quasi-legal status for 2 years at a time. The court ruling is seen as little more than a stopgap measure. The Association of Medical Colleges notes that approximately 27,000 DACA recipients are healthcare workers and claims that the country is not prepared to fill the loss of these workers. Shortages would be felt most seriously in medically underserved areas, such as rural communities and poor neighborhoods. The authors conclude that, quote, after decades of political posturing, including xenophobic comments by President Trump and the array of costly taxpayer-funded lawsuits ending in Supreme Court proclamations, the time has come to end the games and the harm. We must welcome not only Dreamers, but also their parents and all other undocumented immigrants who have become members of our communities. They deserve it, and we do too. Such actions would certainly allow us to live up to the American ethos etched in the arms of Lady Liberty. Good evening and welcome to Civil Rights and Wrongs on Co-op 91.7 in Austin, streaming through koop.org. I'm your host, Bob Daly. We have several guests this evening. Chito Vela is an immigration attorney with the firm Walker Gates Vela. He has worked in the Texas Attorney General's office and is former board chair of Workers' Defense Project. Josue Lucas is the owner of Josh Events in Dallas, which specializes in quinceañeras. He's also a choreographer. And we have Kelvin Lopez Garcia. He's in Houston and is a staff member for the organization JOLT, which seeks to empower Latinx civic engagement. Both Josue and Kelvin are DACA recipients. And we have our regular guest, Jim Harrington, founder of the Texas Civil Rights Project. Co-op's Michelle Manning Scott is here too. Welcome to all of you. Let's start with some brief introductions. Chito, you've been on the show. Just briefly, tell us about yourself.
Well, I'm originally from Laredo and I am an attorney now doing criminal defense and immigration work, and I've been doing immigration work for about 10 years now, represented a lot of folks, of DACA holders, gotten a lot of people DACA, fought deportation cases against DACA recipients. That's really my clients that have DACA, my DACA kids, although they're not kids anymore, are really close to my heart. Those have been some of the most rewarding cases that I've handled, and also, sadly, some of the most heartbreaking cases that I've handled.
And Josue, up in Dallas, tell us a little more about yourself.
My name is Josue. I was born in Mexico. I was raised here in Dallas, Texas, for the past 30 years. I am a DACA recipient as well. My parents did get deported almost 10 years ago. It's been hard, but I've learned to maintain myself, keep pushing forward, and do something with myself after all this that's happening. I am a choreographer, and I do have my own business. I do have my own business, tuxedo business and dress business as well. And yeah, I love what I do.
Great. Well, we'll come back to you. We definitely want to hear more of your story. And Kelvin, tell us a little about yourself.
Hello there. My name is Kelvin. I'm currently serving as the Houston organizer for JOLTS Action Incorporated, which is essentially a civic engagement-based organization that focuses primarily on Black and brown people of color. Just to get more civically engaged, to start, you know, engaging more in voter registration, getting people to fill out the census, all forms of civic engagement. I was born in Managua, Nicaragua, and I actually came to the United States about 21 years ago now. And as of right now, I'm still a DACA recipient. It's my duty, it's my hope to encourage as many people as possible to, you know, get more civically engaged. So that's kind of what I do for now. I do have background in immigration legal offices as well. I used to be a paralegal for about 3 years in an immigration law office. I also was involved in the CARA pro bono project down in Dilley, Texas, where I served as a paralegal to help those that were detained at the moment in immigration detention. And then finally, I have been community organizing for the last 7 years.
Great. JOLT is certainly an organization close to my heart. Until recently, I was on the board of directors there, expecting great things out of JOLT. Cheeto, it's been about 6 weeks since the DACA ruling. Maybe you could just give us a quick summary of what the Supreme Court ruled on that and a little about what's happened in the meantime.
So the Supreme Court overruled the Trump administration's killing of DACA, but they did it on a very, very narrow ground. They basically said that the president has the authority to terminate DACA, but that there is an administrative process that he has to go through in order to terminate the program, and he has not done. So they said that for now, the program survives. The president can now, you know, begin that process of properly ending the program. But fortunately, it's going to take about 6 to 9 months or so for an administrative review process. And it is, I'd say, very likely at this point that if President Trump is not reelected, that we will end his administration with the program still intact. And hopefully another administration will just revive the program and keep it going right now.
And at least revive the program, if not actually pass some legislation that's a bit more secure than this presidential executive order.
Absolutely. And that is definitely the goal. You know, I tell you, from my point of view, you know, we've got hundreds really of DACA clients at this point. And actually, we have hired also a number of DACA folks. And at this point, a lot of DACA holders have had that, you know, been in status, in DACA status for years, and have just kind of continued to renew. And so, I mean, they've really, I think, at this point, shown everything they can possibly show in order to justify, you know, becoming legal permanent residents. Not that they really had to do that. I mean, they, you know, these are folks that were brought here not of their own accord. They did nothing wrong. And really, they deserve, you know, legal permanent resident status on its own merits. But at this point, someone that's had DACA for 6 years, 8 years, you know, has a good, clean criminal record, has been complying with all the requirements. You know, there's educational requirements. You have to have been here for a certain amount of time. So we really do need to get folks long-term solutions so they can continue to build their lives and contribute to society.
Right. Now, unfortunately, the Trump administration didn't take this Supreme Court ruling kind of laying down. They've made a few overtures since that time. What's happened?
We're all still trying to get a grip on where we are. But at this point, they are not accepting new DACA applications. They are allowing people to renew their existing DACA status. So one of the requirements, and let me just explain briefly why that's so important. Yeah. One of the requirements for DACA, to have DACA, is that you have to have a minimum age and 15 years old. And there were a lot of people that when the program was announced, they met all the qualifications, but they did not meet the minimum age requirements. A lot of people now have aged into DACA. You know, when the program was initially announced in, let's say, like June 2012, they were not eligible for DACA, but, you know, they were, let's say, 8 years old, you know, something like that. But now they're, you know, 16, 18, they're adults. They need the work permit. They need the Social Security number. They meet all of the other eligibility criteria, but the Trump administration is currently refusing to accept their new applications. And that's in direct violation of the Supreme Court and direct violation of the law. They just completely and totally on their own decision are refusing to do that. Some of the district courts have called that into question, and hopefully we'll see an order coming down the road that will open up the program to new applicants. But that's where we are right now, unfortunately. Folks can renew, but they're not accepting new applicants. And also, just to make one further point, DACA holders can do something called advanced parole, which is you can apply to leave the country for an educational, medical, family emergency, work-related travel. And many DACA holders have used that provision for employment purposes, to visit family, ill family. The Trump administration right now is refusing to grant advance parole except in what they cite as exceptional circumstances, which are at this point undefined. So again, they're refusing to implement DACA as the law says that it should be implemented, and just ignoring the Supreme Court's order and other federal court's orders.
You know, all of this just feels like so much red meat that he's throwing to his base. What can he do to get people riled up? That's personal opinion on my part. I think so many of us were so relieved by even this ruling, which, you know, on the face of it was little more than a kind of a procedural slap in the face at the president. The consequences of this thing, maybe the Supreme Court felt this way too. Consequences of deporting 700,000-800,000 residents here who have been, you know, spent their whole lives here, to me is just unthinkable.
Yeah. You know, Bob, the day that the decision was announced, you know, the Supreme Court took forever to announce it. And as an immigration attorney and as someone, you know, so many people in my life have DACA, clients and otherwise, you know, we were just kind of every Monday that the decisions were coming down, we were just kind of fingers crossed, waiting, very pessimistic. And finally, at the very end of the term, you know, the Supreme Court decision comes down. I tell you, that was probably, as an attorney, one of the most emotional days I've ever had as an attorney. The relief that I felt was just tremendous. I was just dreading if the Supreme Court had struck it down. The phone calls, you know, and just, you know, the tears and the anguish from so many of my clients, you know, with what do we do? What do we do? What do we do? And the sense of relief when, like, I wasn't going to have to deal with that, that my clients were going to be okay, that our employees were going to be okay, friends and family were going to be okay. It was just overwhelming. And it was, like, it's really one of just such a joyful day. We had like a party here in the office to celebrate. And we were all just so happy to hear the news.
So how about you, Josue? What was it like for you when you heard the news?
It was good. It was good news. I was happy to hear that. I think it's something, like I said, something very personal. And for me, it does help. But for me, it was good news to hear that. I think I was in the same position where, well, what's going to happen with us if it gets denied? What happens if it gets stopped? What's going to happen with us? But I was happy. I think we have fought a lot. And we have proven ourselves to the country that we are essential people. We are here to work. We're not here to steal anybody's jobs, but we're here to do the work, and we're here to do just like everyone else is here to do. We pay taxes. We work hard. We make ourselves go up little by little. Businesses, we have doctors, nurses, but we all contribute a little bit to the society and to the country. But for me, it was good news to hear that. I think it was a big relief. And like Chito said, it did bring tears to my eyes too, because it's something that you don't know what tomorrow holds for you. You don't know if you're going to be secure, if you're still going to be okay to be here, or you're going to get deported. You don't know that you've been through that experience. It's just nerve-wracking of what could happen next.
How about you, Kelvin? What was it like for you when you heard the news?
Honestly, as an organizer, we've been coming out of the whole Supreme Court decision, we had been planning for months in on advance, just preparing, right? And I can tell you straight up right now that I was actually one of the people that kind of felt that we were preparing for a negative response. We were preparing for the Supreme Court to side with President and pretty much end the program of DACA. That's what we were prepared for. So when on that Thursday morning, we heard the news that, you know, the program was going to be continued, that the Supreme Court basically made that ruling, I was extremely excited. I wanted to celebrate, because for the first time ever, I felt that, you know, my place in this country, my value in this country was actually, you know, being held for what it's worth. You know, I am a human being. I deserve the rights as everybody else. And that was the first affirmation from my peers that, you know, I do matter. I do deserve to be in this country. So I was extremely ecstatic. I was super, super emotional. And, you know, it made me feel like, you know, our lives weren't used as these political yo-yos anymore.
Yeah. Josue, could you tell us a little more about your story? I think your parents were deported, weren't they, at one point?
Yes, they were deported almost 10 years ago. I mean, for me, it was difficult. I think that's the moment where the whole deportation started to happen. But my parents were just people like other people here, trying to give their kids the best education, try to give us the best that they could, something that it's hard for us to get. It was hard. I still remember like it was yesterday. I remember that we're searching for someone else, saying that we were hitting someone that was suspect of killing somebody in the house, which was not true. They just got us out of nowhere. It was like 3-4 in the morning that morning. And I remember like it was yesterday. It was the last time I hugged my mom, the last time I kissed them. And it's been difficult. And it was something very difficult. But I was surprised, because like I told you, at that moment, I could have gotten deported too. But it was not in God's plans for that to happen. And if not, I would have been in Mexico with them at the moment too. And it's just crazy how life changes you from one day to another. And I had to learn to grow. I had to learn how to be a man for me.
You were 21 at the time, right?
When yes.
Okay. And how old were you when your parents brought you here? Do you know?
I was 6 months, months old.
So you're just an infant.
Yeah.
And just curious, when did you find out that you were undocumented?
Probably around the age of 15 or 14. I think that's when I started, because I wanted to do something in school. And then also because I did start to have health issues. I did receive the kidney transplant as well from my dad. That's when I started to know that, hey, you don't have papers. And it was difficult for us to get financial aid. It was difficult for us to get help from the government just because of our status and here in the United States.
Wow. Did you just say your dad was the donor for your kidney?
Yes. My dad was my kidney donor. Yeah. He was the one that gave me his kidney.
Wow. Jeez. Well, I'm very moved by your story. I mean, just the fact too that in the past 9 years since they've gone, you've established a business, and you know what incredible strength on your part to deal with all that emotionally and yet do something very successful in your life. I admire that.
Thank you. Thank you. Yeah, I think it just took time. I think for us, it was just difficult because we were already a very close family. So going through the process of receiving the kidney transplant, going through dialysis, it was a whole experience during my teenage years until I finally got my transplant through my dad. And but 2-3 years after that, they got deported. So it hurt even more. Yeah. And easily I could have just let go and not focus upon my health, but I decided to do something about it. Yeah. I decided to prove that I could do it. It was hard, but it was not impossible. Wow. Little by little, I'm doing it and accomplishing things little by little.
Yeah, yeah. Kelvin, could you tell us a little more about your story?
Yes, yes, I would love to. So my story is a little bit different. My story, unfortunately, is centered around abuse. So I was only 3 years old when my mother came into my room one night in Managua, Nicaragua, and told me that we were leaving her home. I felt confused and I had so many questions, right? Like any other kid would have questions, like, why are we leaving right now? My mother then refused to answer my questions as she sobbed quietly in the back of a moving truck. Mm-hmm. We then arrived in El Salvador and got prepared to travel to the United States. Later on, my mother finally answered my questions, and for the first time ever, I found out that she was a victim of abuse and that the abuse that I was suffering through as well at the hands of my biological father was not okay. And she made the brave decision to grab me and take me away from my father. Having held 2 degrees in Nicaragua, my mother ended up finding employment doing odd jobs and cleaning houses. I would never get to see her as she would work long hours at factories. And yeah, we were still poor. We were living in Los Angeles at the time and rent was super expensive. And being a single mother, having to pay rent in California, it was a lot. So we were suffering a lot. We were super poor. We ended up moving to Kansas, where I lived for half of my life as well. And there we were also super poor. I remember going to middle school and in high school was kind of weird, because I didn't fit in. I was just extremely impoverished. And I remember having to wear the same uniform every single day because we didn't have the funds to be able to get me like several uniforms. And it was just really, really tough having to grow up in those situations. When I was 13, 14, I was making super terrible life decisions in middle school and in high school. I was getting into fights. Like, I felt hopeless. I felt like, you know, I didn't really have a future. Mm-hmm. Going into high school, I wasn't really trying as hard as I could have tried in school and in my courses, because I didn't really know what the plan was for me after I graduated from high school.
Yeah.
I that's when I knew that I was undocumented. I knew that I wasn't going to be able to drive legally. I wasn't going to be able to work legally. So all these exercises that, you know, they had us do in middle school and in high school to envision what you wanted to be when you grew up meant nothing to me. Like, I knew what I wanted to be. I just knew that there was no way for me to get there.
Yeah.
So when I was 17, I was fortunate enough to be one of the very many recipients of the new DACA program and to be eligible for the DACA program. And that's when I felt, you know, just more relief. I felt like I was slowly but surely, you know, starting to feel more human, like I mattered in this country. After that, I remember applying for my very first job at Pizza Hut and how excited I was after, you know, being prepared to have to do like, you know, some jobs like my mother did growing up to be able to find my way of living in the United States. So I was able to work at that first job. I was super excited. I was finally able to help my family out with the bills. Our financial situation as a family like just got a lot better because my mom didn't have to pay for everything anymore. To buy school supplies for my little brother who didn't have the funds for school supplies. I was able to buy him shoes. I was able to, you know, help raise like my little brother and, you know, be as happy and as normal a family as possible. And then, you know, having that opportunity, that authorization for employment, got me super ecstatic, made me feel hopeful again about a possibility of my future. And even though I had a terrible GPA, I was able to graduate from high school with really high SAT and ACT scores. So despite my low GPA, I was able to get into a lot of different many universities. You know, even though in the state of Kansas where I went to school at, you don't have really access to financial aid. If you are not a U.S. citizen or a permanent resident, you know, even though I would have no way of paying for school, even though banks didn't really want to deal with me because of my status and because of my age for loans, I was at least at the very minimum lucky that I had a work permit to help me work three different jobs to put myself through college. And even though like I had to work a lot harder to put myself through college, I didn't take it lightly. You know, like I felt blessed. I felt happy that I had that work permit, that I was able to do that, even though I didn't have as much help as everybody else. And then that's kind of when I started getting more involved in politics and getting more involved in anything immigration, because I kind of felt super thankful for the opportunity that I was given. And I knew that, you know, out of the 11 million undocumented people in the United States, 750,000 that are eligible for DACA, like that's not enough of a solution for the immigration situation in the United States. So I felt that I would move towards political science and just doing my best to organize communities so one day we could see a solution for all 11 million and not just us.
Right. And so now you're working to get other Latinos and people of color more politically engaged.
That's correct, yes.
Jim or Cheeto, you've been in this business from the legal end for some time. Do you have any comments about what you've heard from Josue and Kelvin? I mean, is this typical of your experience of DACA recipients?
You know, the stories I think that we hear are just as awesome and impressive as of the two that we just heard. In my mind, it also really justifies the program, you know, and why it is that we would have an administration that would basically try to do away with a program that enables and benefits not only the individuals involved in the program, but our society. I mean, it's clear our society, just from these two stories that we heard in the last half hour, it's clear that our society has benefited greatly as a community from these two recipients. And why we don't welcome that and try to have that system, the DACA program, flourish, I think speaks a lot, frankly, to the kind of drumbeating of racism that we've heard from the administration from the very beginning.
Yeah. We're speaking with Cheeto Vela, Josue Lucas, and Kelvin Lopez Garcia about Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, or DACA. We need to take a short station break, but we'll be right back. Stay tuned. Welcome back to Civil Rights and Wrongs on Co-op 91.7 in Austin, streaming through koop.org. I'm your host, Bob Daly. This evening's program was homecrafted and recorded on August 5th and 6th. We're speaking with Cheeto Vela, Josue Lucas, and Kelvin Lopez Garcia about Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, or DACA. Let's continue.
The stories that I hear are very similar to that. There are these really heartwarming and inspiring stories of people overcoming obstacles to better their lives. I mean, they're really just emblematic of the American dream, almost all of the DACA stories that I hear. And, you know, what to me is kind of ironic is that support for the DACA program is very, very high. Even among Republicans, their majority of people polled will say they support this kind of relief for DACA candidates, for people that were brought here as children. Do they deserve an opportunity? And majorities of Republicans and overwhelming majorities of independents and of Democrats agree that we should give folks an opportunity And that's why the whole situation with trying to eliminate the DACA program has been, you know, such a head scratcher from a political point of view.
Yeah, I don't get it. You're absolutely right. I mean, there's bipartisan support for this. And yet politically over the years, when you go back to 2001, when the DREAM Act was first proposed, again, there was bipartisan support for this. And yet I don't totally remember what all was going on there and why it didn't. But I'm sure somebody was pandering to someone in their base and saw an opportunity to score some points on this.
I will say that, you know, I mean, I do appreciate that President Obama enabled the program in 2012, but I'm still so disappointed and upset that that first Congress, that 2009 Congress with the Democratic supermajorities, was not able to pass the DREAM Act. It still kind of boggles the mind that it was just such a simple thing to do, wide support, and unfortunately, you know, our government couldn't get it done. And it's such a disappointment.
What about the DACA folks on the line here? What's your take on what's going on and why it's opposed?
Go ahead, Josue.
For me, it's just hoping and praying for the best. I think the president could do what he wants. And at the end of the day, I've always felt that if one door closes, another one's going to open. Whatever's going to happen, it's already in God's hands. And there's nothing that we could do. The only thing we could do is just think positive, push forward, and a push comes to shove where nothing could happen. And well, at the end of the day, it's okay. I think we had the time of working and doing something with our lives. And at this point, just hoping and praying for the best.
Kelvin, you've been a political science student and you're working in a civic engagement organization. What's your take on the opposition to DACA?
Honestly, I think the opposition to DACA truly lies in those that are just xenophobic and those that are racist. I don't know how else to sugarcoat that. Honestly, DACA is an amazing program. As a DACA recipient myself, as someone that's been to DC several times to protest at the steps of the Capitol outside of the Supreme Court, all the DACA recipients I've met have been extremely amazing individuals. I believe that this, you know, this is something that we deserve. We've been contributing to society. I don't even want to get into the spending power of DACA recipients and, you know, what we contribute to the economy, because it's not even about that. It's just, it's a fact that we're humans and we deserve to be seen as such. It's the fact that we don't really have any recollection of our previous homes. So we can't really think about what home is whenever we get told you go back to, you know, where we're from. Like, I don't have any recollection of Nicaragua, so I can't really do that. I think that to be able to really curb this opposition, we need to get more legislators on board with programs that will affect DACA recipients and even general immigration reform at a larger level. We need to pressure our Congress people, our representatives or senators. I'm sure they're happy to take your suggestions because it is their job. Representatives or legislators, we don't work for them. We have to remember that. They work for us. They get paid by our tax dollars, including mine, even though I'm not eligible to vote.
Well, we've got just a few minutes left here. Cheeto, you talked a little about what could happen if there's a change in administration here. And I think it's a fair assumption that if Biden is elected, that all this opposition is going to melt away pretty quickly. And hopefully, if we've got enough of the right people in Congress, we may get some legislation that puts an end to the whole tentative nature of all this.
I really hope so, Bob. And Kelvin, like his story about how the grant of DACA opened up possibilities and was really transformative. That is a story that I have seen time after time in my 10 years practicing immigration law. You know, so many people that, I mean, we initially represented them in 2012, and now, you know, we've renewed their DACAs, you know, four or five times at this point. And, you know, you see how much it means to those people. You know, they can get credit now. They can buy a car. They can go to school. They can get jobs. They can so many things that they did not have access to, you know, dreams that they weren't even really allowed to dream. now they can't. And I've just seen it be so transformative for so many people and been just such a good thing overall. I really hope that the program is saved and that folks with DACA become legal permanent residents and eventually U.S. citizens.
Amen to that. Josue, do you have any closing thoughts?
Thing is, just want to say thank you for the opportunity. And like I said, I do hope and I do pray for the best. I hope that, like Kevin said, and like everyone else has said, hopefully they could see that we're humans here. And then we just want the best for our children, for my future children, for my future generations. I want them to see that we did something about it and something was able to be done. And I just appreciate everybody for having me here today. And appreciate everybody's support and hopefully praying for the best, hoping we get good news soon and something good happens out of all this that's going around.
Jim, did you have any parting thoughts?
Well, this is something I think is really important for everybody to keep in mind in terms of the November election. And I think it's just as important for people who are DACA recipients to get their story out there. Nothing brings about votes better than personal stories. And I think this is a really good avenue to organize and encourage people to vote.
Agreed. How about that, Kelvin?
Yeah, I definitely agree. November is coming. It's right around the corner. You know, the deadline to register to vote is also right around the corner in October. Voting is it's a privilege. I wish it was a right, but it's a privilege. And, you know, for those that can vote, that are listening to this, even if you have current opinions about the current folks that are running for elected office, if you're able to vote, trust me, I would definitely love to vote in my own interest.
Yeah, amen to that. Michelle, you've been pretty quiet, but I know that voting has been your pet cause.
Yeah, as a member of the League of Women Voters, yes, it is. We all know how important that is, and certainly the best way to use our voices to get the word out about the causes that are important to us and to make sure that the people that will support those causes are the ones that get into office. I was curious, I was going to ask Kelvin what kind of participation there was within JOLT from DACA supporters, even though they can't vote. I'm wondering if there are DACA recipients who are engaged through JOLT just to try and do what you're doing, basically.
Yeah, definitely. We currently have a leadership institute that is happening actually at the end of the month. It is a crash course on organizing where we will essentially teach everyone, all of our participants, how to become an organizer, how to plan for events, how to increase turnout, how to get people passionate about a subject through just one-on-one conversations, and especially applying that in a more digital realm due to the pandemic. So if you want more information, JOLTTX, JOLTTX.org/leadership-institute.
I want to thank each and every one of you for joining us here today. This has been very moving for me and to listen, especially to Josue and Kelvin. Cheeto, we thank you for your continuing efforts. Like you said, you're on a new project and you're working on the wall these days. Is that right? Or working against the wall?
Yeah, it's a really exciting new case that co-counsel Carlos Flores down in Laredo was hired by Zapata County, a border county, to fight the border wall. And that's been dominating my time nowadays. And that's another, I mean, you know, talk about like the elimination of DACA as a symbol of xenophobia and racism. I mean, the wall is another one. And I'm from the area and it's a project that's really close to my heart and really hoping to win that case and stop the border wall construction in South Texas.
We'll be talking to Gus Bova from the Texas Observer in 2 weeks about that very topic. So stay tuned. All right. Well, thank you one and all, and wish everyone the very best.
Thank you, Bob and Jim, Josue, Kelvin, Melanie. Great to hear the stories, and best to y'all.
Thank you, everyone.
Thank you.
Good job.
Nice talking to all of you.
Good luck on your work, Kelvin, Josue.
Thank you.
It's Friday afternoon, August 7th, and we've got a few minutes left here for our friend Austin Sanders from the Austin Chronicle. How you doing, Austin?
I'm doing all right, Bob. How are you?
Okay, just fine, thanks. Trying to stay cool like everybody else.
Oh, yeah.
You've been writing about the police academy, I understand. What's going on there?
Yeah, so there's been a big push, you know, really for the last 2 or 3 years from advocates to reform the academy, the way that cadets learn how to become officers, to make them more community-oriented police officers. At the Chronicle, we obtained these 3 reports that were conducted internally by APD. 2 of them were conducted by an actual APD staffer, Dr. Sarah Villanueva, who's been a longtime professor of psychology at St. Edward's. And she took this job at APD to look at the department's training and recruiting practices. She was a manager over those areas. And then a 3rd report was handled by a contract with another academic named Dr. Miguel Ferguson. And really what these 3 reports together, the picture they paint is basically a problem with what is characterized as the paramilitary culture at the academy. And really, this is a problem through policing as a profession overall. Paramilitary culture refers to kind of the militarization of police forces in not just the, you know, the armories that we see departments have in cities, big and small, but really the way that senior officers or sergeants and lieutenants talk to people lower on the chain of command. And there's a lot of what some former cadets who dropped out of the academy characterize as harassment and abuse, you know, really is designed to emulate military culture, like boot camps and drill sergeants and things of that nature. And what these reports say is basically that style of teaching at the academy is outdated, and it's really harmful to the department's stated goal from city leaders of establishing better police community relations. So advocates and some council members are really seizing on these reports to get the academy shut down for the next few classes, give it time to be reformed and improved. So, you know, the next class of cadets is trained under a new system. And in the meantime, it kind of frees up these savings, which could be used for a variety of different uses in the FY21 budget, which is set to be approved on Wednesday.
So, geez, backing up a little bit, I remember when it was 2 or 3 cadets dropped out. Oh, I think it was about April last year, and the Statesman did a story on them, and maybe you guys did too. But geez, now what you're saying is that it almost sounds like a kind of a boot camp atmosphere.
Yeah, totally. It was interesting talking with Dr. Villanueva about it. Obviously, she comes from a really educational academic background. And so she really focused on the teaching method. And one thing that she told me is that a lot of the instructors, you know, she applauds them, but much like a lot of public school teachers, they just don't have enough resources. They're not provided adequate training, classroom resources, educational curriculum materials. They don't have adequate resources. And what she told me was, it seems like some of the instructors feel like they are cops teaching cadets instead of teachers who are teaching cops. So I think that really gets at the fundamental issues with the academy. It's in the way that cadets are taught, not necessarily the curriculum, although that is a problem. It's just not really the issue that Villanueva was studying in her reports.
So I guess people are saying is that that creates an atmosphere that ultimately could become toxic throughout the whole police department.
Yeah, totally. You mentioned the cadets that had dropped out of prior academies, and I think it was around 10 actually that dropped out and wrote a letter to department chiefs outlining their complaints and the abuse that they encountered. And for this story, I talked with one of those former cadets, Summer Spisak. What she told me is the reports focus on the culture inside of the classroom, which is a problem. But as she put it, that culture pervades the entire cadet experience. It's not just inside the classroom. This kind of militaristic boot camp atmosphere happens outside of the class when instructors are just interacting with cadets. The department has tried to address that, but there's questions from advocates and council members if it's been enough to address those issues. And if the academy should be shut down for basically a year to give more time for those reforms to be made.
So normally in a year's time, there are what, two classes? Is that right?
Yeah. That's been historically the average. I think there was three scheduled for this year, but one has been canceled at this point, and the next one is scheduled for November, which this is where there's some tension on council. Some council members are pushing to cancel that November class and any that were scheduled for next year, so for 2021. Basically, that frees up between $10 and $13 million, a pretty significant amount of money that could be, you know, reserved to invest into a reformed academy. So basically, once these issues are addressed, the city and the department are going to want to bring in new officers under that revised curriculum, revised teaching style, who hopefully, you know, would adhere to the vision for policing that advocates and community members are calling for. Or it could be the savings, the 10 to 13 million in savings could be invested in EMS or the 911 call center or some of these other public safety alternatives that council is hoping to fund by reducing the police department budget.
And so you mentioned like council members. I know last week we talked about Jimmy Flanagan had some pretty far-reaching proposals for the department. Is he on board with this, or who's promoting this?
So I would say Greg Kassar and Leslie Poole have both introduced, I guess, you know, rough drafts of amendments that would cancel the next three cadet classes. So that's November, and then the two that would take place next year. Flanagan and Natasha Harper Madison, who have also been, you know, leading on potential cuts to the department budget, they're less committed to canceling the November class or the two next year. They really want to see if reforms can be made before November. Mm-hmm. And then if there's a satisfactory set of curriculum and teaching styles in place, then they'll want to bring in recruits into that academy to, again, graduate a different type of police officer, more closely adheres to this vision that they have laid out. But they've also said, if those reforms are not implemented successfully to satisfaction by November, they're open to canceling that class as well. But I guess they're just not wanting to fully commit to that cancellation right now.
They'd be real happy if they were assured that there had been some fundamental reforms and that we could actually train and graduate some new cadets under the new system.
Absolutely. Yeah, because that's one thing some of the staff in the budget office at the city have been emphasizing. In some ways, shutting down the cadet academy only offers temporary savings, because mm-hmm. eventually the city is going to have to start funding the academy again. They're going to need, right, through normal attrition and retirements, you're going to need new police officers. However, right, it does, in effect, reduce the size of the patrol force, because right now the police department has, I think it's about 170 vacancies, 180 vacant officer positions. Mm-hmm. And without academy, you can't graduate cadets into officers to fill those vacant positions. Right. You do get some ongoing savings because you're not creating new officers who require salary and benefits and equipment. So you do get some ongoing savings there, but there is like a one-time savings aspect to it as well.
Focusing a little more on the budget, we're getting kind of close to the end of the process, aren't we?
Yeah, so they are set to begin, you know, deliberating on all of their amendments on Wednesday. By Friday, basically, they'll have to approve it. And so it'll either be Wednesday or Friday that they approve it. And it's looking like what they'll adopt is basically a budget that funds the police department for 6 months. And what that means is, you know, before a 6 month period, halfway through the fiscal year, which is really more like in February or so, is what I'm told by council and other staffers, the council will have to approve the rest of the police department's funding for the rest of the year. And the reason they want to do this, it'll give city staff time to work out how to achieve some of these more complicated goals associated with reducing the police department's budget. Just as an example, another idea that is not really controversial politically police supporters, reform advocates support this idea of taking the DNA lab, the, you know, forensics evidence analysts that support detectives and investigations. They want to take that department and basically make it its own entity, take it outside of the department and make it operate somewhat independently. There's a lot of reasons that everyone is really supporting this idea, but it's not something that the council can just flip a switch and say the funding for the DNA lab is no longer a police department function. They have to decide who is going to run this. Is it going to be a joint venture between the city and the county? Is it going to be a its own sort of independent local government entity like the Sobering Center? Do sworn police personnel have to help operate it? So these are the kind of complex questions that cannot be answered by August 12th when the council is set to adopt the budget. So by funding the police department for 6 months, it gives staff time to figure out how to deal with these trickier ideas like moving the DNA lab out from the police department. The council, by 6 months, but they really want to do it as quickly as possible, will vote on a budget amendment that officially moves that funding out of the department and into its own thing.
So in the meantime, for the 6 months, is that basically 50% of what Spencer Cronk had proposed to them, or where does it stand?
We won't really know the answer to that question until council deliberates and votes on budget amendments, because there is going to be this 6 month, you know, some consider it a delay. They're punting the issue into next year. There's this aspect, but there will also be immediate cuts, things that reduce the police department's budget immediately that will not go back into the department. So the cadet classes are a good example. There was supposed to be a class in July. Obviously, that didn't happen. So that's some savings that council will have. And so that's like an immediate cut. Another one on the table is the mounted patrol, cops on horses that are used at protests and other mass gatherings. There's talk about cutting funding for that part of the department. And that's something that would happen immediately that would reduce the fiscal year 21 budget for the police department immediately. So once those decisions are made, then the rest of the department will receive 6 months funding. And at that 6 months, there will be more cuts, council says, and what is not cut at that point will be funded for another 6 months.
So it sounds like it's very much a work in progress and is going to remain that way for some time to come.
Absolutely. Yeah, that's really the way that City Manager Spencer Cronk pitched what has become known as reimagining public safety, this idea of divesting from the police department and reinvesting in other agencies and services. He's always envisioned it as an iterative process that's going to take weeks and months to really figure out. Obviously, that has not aligned with community demands from, you know, activist groups and just, you know, regular people who don't normally get involved in city politics. They are wanting much more urgent action cuts now. So it's going to be a really tricky balance for council to meet those demands while giving staff the time to really work out how to achieve these more complicated changes to public safety in the future.
Well, speaking of pushing things out, it sounds like AISD met last night.
Yeah, so they had a really late meeting Thursday night. That's August 6th when they met. They didn't meet until 9 o'clock, which is, you know, a problem in itself. They didn't end up starting to hold the meeting publicly until like 9:30. There was 4 hours of public comment, pre-recorded public comment they had to listen to. And then the trustees deliberated and finally voted around 3 a.m. It was a really late night. But yeah, what they decided was to adjust the school calendar to push the start date until September 8th, which they were supposed to start August 18th. So they are moving a few weeks ahead. And that basically to accommodate for that lost time, each school day will start 10 minutes earlier, and then they'll go a little bit later into June. I think June 5th or something will be the new last day. The first 4 weeks will be virtual. And then after that, the board has applied for a waiver through the Texas Education Agency to continue virtual learning for another 4 weeks with the option for students to attend in person if they need to. It's looking like that waiver has not been approved. It's still pending, but it's looking like teachers and students could be going, you know, mostly virtual for at least the first 8 weeks of school in AISD.
Virtual learning, when they tried that last spring, they were having to send school buses out to create hotspots in the neighborhoods.
Some students who will be invited to take class in person will be those who cannot get reliable internet access, who don't have access to technology. I think it's a sign of how threatening opening schools is right now in person that they are voting for this delay to really emphasize virtual learning for possibly 8 weeks.
That's probably about all we have time for. Really appreciate the summary and especially the news about the police academy.
It's good talking with you. I'm sure the next time we'll talk, we'll be able to see how much city council actually decreased the police budget. I look forward to talking to you about that.
Well, that's all for this evening. Stay safe, everyone.